Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Don't Tell Me The Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy and I am delighted to be joined by Tim Henman this week, just in time for the start of Wimbledon, which is very exciting. The theme of this episode is, what defines success? Tim reached the semi-finals of Wimbledon four times, as well as two other major semi-finals. He was ranked as high as number four in the world, and that's all despite not being tipped for great things as a junior. And yet, in some quarters, there is a false narrative that somehow Tim fell short or failed or even choked when it mattered most. So in this episode, we explore what does success mean? To what degree is the winners and losers narrative that we hear all about in sport and in life too simplistic? We talk about exploring your potential rather than setting a goal and limiting yourself, and why everyone's journey and trajectory is different. We discuss gratitude, honesty, humility, as well as the fickle nature of external approval, and why having intrinsic, internal self-worth is where the gold is. Now, Tim unquestionably raised the bar of British tennis significantly. Before he came along, expectations were low, and we explore how that impacted Andy Murray and even allowed him to go on and become an all-time great of the game. I'll be working at Wimbledon for BBC TV for the fortnight, so keep your eyes peeled for yours truly on BBC 1 and 2 with Sue Barker and Claire Boarding, of course. A quick note before we get to this episode, thanks to everyone who sent in messages and emails of late, and huge apologies because I haven't had time to reply due to the sheer volume as well as all the other things I have going on. But I assure you, I read every single one and they all make a really big impression on me. So if you have written in, sincerely, thank you very much. A reminder, if you want to sign up for my weekly newsletter, you can do so on my website, simonmundy.com. My social media channels are at Simon Mundy, and I'll be posting plenty of stuff from the championships over the next couple of weeks on Instagram in particular. But that's enough of the housekeeping. Let's get to this week's episode with Tim Henman. Tim Henman, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks, Simon. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Tim. I'm thrilled to have you on the podcast. As you know, tennis is very much my favourite sport, so I'm going to have to rein in some of my geekier urges.
Don't do that.
I'll have to, otherwise we'll be here all day. But we will talk about some of the highlights of your career, as well as extract some of the lessons that you've learned and that others can take from things like your attitude and your outlook and the way you've reflected back on your career and what you achieved. And I do think it's fertile ground for broader life lessons. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I think when when I reflect all the way back to probably when I first picked up a racket, and I probably don't remember much of that. I was only 2.5 or 3 at those early stages. That's where your dreams are first dreamt, if that makes sense. And then for my mum to take me to Wimbledon the first time when I was 6 and see Bjorn Borg play, that was, as I've said before, that was when I made my one and only career decision that I wanted to be a professional tennis player. And you know, there's no doubt that it's a long journey. There's a journey of many highs and many lows. I've never said I've had a real job. And I think when you can have, a hobby that you're so passionate about it makes you feel very fortunate.
I'd agree with that, Tim. You haven't had a proper job, but I'd also say we're all the richer for it. Now, you were born into something of a tennis dynasty, into a good tennis stock. I know your mother played tennis to a high level. I know she played at Wimbledon. And then, of course, there's the legend of your great-grandmother, the first woman to serve overarm at the championships. I believe your great-grandfather or grandfather played at Wimbledon too. So, yeah, you do come from good tennis stock, don't you?
Yes, I mean, my mum played in the national championships that used to be at Wimbledon. My grandparents both played at Wimbledon, and my great-grandmother, as you mentioned, played at Wimbledon as well. There's no doubt that's an interesting story. It certainly wasn't the reason why I played the game. I got 2 older brothers that played a lot of sport growing up. My dad has always been very keen on lots of different sports, participated a lot. So growing up, yeah, we 2 older brothers. We lived in a village with a garden. And so, after school, it was, whether it was rugby, football, cricket, hockey, or tennis, there was always a bat and a ball on the go. But I played all of them, but I played tennis because I loved it the most. And I was probably, that was the sport that I was best at. So yes, there is a sort of tennis history there, but it never really influenced me. I wouldn't necessarily say I was so aware of it at a young age.
No. And you were picked up by the Slater squad.
Yeah.
At an early age. The Slater squad operated outside the jurisdiction of the Lawn Tennis Association, the national governing body. It was set up by David Lloyd of David Lloyd Leisure and Tennis Club fame. And I know you were a late bloomer and were small compared to a lot of your peers growing up as a teenager.
Yeah.
And I also know that one of the top coaches at the Slater squad, as well as David too, in fact, recognised that one of your greatest strengths was between your ears, was your attitude. So looking back, can you recognise that you did have the mental aptitude to make the most of your abilities from a very young age?
Yes, I think is the simple answer to that question. And, if I elaborate on that a little bit, I was keen on my tennis. I was playing a lot growing up. And then when I was about 9, maybe 10, I used to go to the David Lloyd Centre. It was the first one that he had built at that stage, David Lloyd Heston. And I used to have a lesson for an hour every week with Onnie Parran, who was a Kiwi who played in the sort of early mid-70s, made quarters of Wimbledon. And, at that time, David Lloyd was thinking of setting up a tennis academy. He had never been particularly impressed with the LTA's equivalent. And he was keen to try and, produce some world-class British players. And that's when he set up the academy. Jim Slater, who was a sort of city financier at the time, he had done something similar with chess, believe it or not, back in the day when he felt that there should be a lot better British chess players, when I think it was being dominated by the Russians. And he transformed chess in this country, and they linked up to try and do something similar with tennis. So that was when I was 11, and we went to Reed School as part of that sort of Slater scheme. And that was a massively important part of my development. I was one of the best juniors in the country at the age of sort of 10, 11, 12. And then, physically I was a late developer. So, I think in juniors, sometimes your results are dictated a lot by the physicality, your strength and speed and being a late developer. My results were not particularly good at the age of, 15, 16, 17. But, when you go back to that attitude, I was obsessed with the game. I was so passionate about it. I wanted to practice and train all day, every day. I just loved it. And so, that motivation, that hunger and desire, that competitive instinct was something that I always had. And there was no doubt that, through the difficult times, my development through the junior game was not plain sailing. I certainly needed that resilience to keep bouncing back.
And that so the resilience was simply born of a passion and a love for the sport.
Yes, but there's not many people more competitive than my dad to this day. It's a combination of obviously the way I thought and approached things, but also, there must be something genetic in there that, my dad was a good sportsman and was highly competitive. I was the youngest of three boys and, I had to fight pretty hard to keep up.
Yeah, it's the classic youngest sibling story, often the ones that go on and succeed. But in terms of the Slater squad, because who else was in there? So there was James Bailey, who won the Australian Open Juniors in, I think, 93.
Yeah.
Jamie Delgado, who won the Orange Bowl, so the Junior World Championships, essentially. And I think that was, maybe 92.
Yeah.
And Mark Moreso. And you weren't seen as the pick of the bunch, were you? You were, yes, they recognised you had this fight and that you were going to grow, but they had you down as a double specialist even, didn't they?
Not exactly, but no, you're right. There was James Davidson as well, who's now been working on the tour as a coach, who was part of the scheme. No, I don't think I was, certainly not the best. And, there were, talent comes in many different forms. I think there, in terms of the sort of natural gift of the game, Mark Moreso was probably the best of the bunch at that stage. But that's one of the challenges of tennis to this day, is that there are, there are three attributes. There's technical, physical and mental, and you cannot be devoid of any of those. And they develop at different speeds. And so, I had a great attitude. My game was coming along. I was improving all the time. But, physically, I was probably, held back against bigger or stronger juniors at that time.
When you were with the Slater squad, if someone had said to you, okay, what are your goals? What do you want to go on and achieve? What do you expect to be able to go on and achieve as a senior player? What would you have said if someone had asked you that at, say, 15, 16?
I think at that time, and this is, I think, an interesting part of my journey. I think at the age of 18, 19, when I'd come out of the junior game, I was starting to play the bottom rung of professional tennis. It was satellites back in the day. If you'd have said to me at that stage, right here, if you sign on the dotted line for the next 10 years, you're going to be ranked from, 75 to 100 in the world. You'll play in the four Grand Slams. You'll compete on the main tour for the next decade. I would have bitten both arms off and signed immediately. And, then as my game developed, and all of a sudden at the end of 95, I think it was, I broke into the top 100. So I was 21 at that time, finished the year 99. Then you think, wow, things are really progressing. And, what's the next goal? Is it top 75, top 50? And then, as that year progressed, I had even better results. I think I finished 29 in the world, I'm slightly guessing. And then all of a sudden, you've broken into the top 50 and, you're close to the top 30. And then you think, well, could I get to the top 20? And you do, you continue to raise the bar. You want to, try and get higher and higher, but you don't know where you're going to get to. And so that's where, certainly, I'm able to look back at this whole journey from the age of, well, you could say from the age of 3 to 33, but when I left school at 16 to 33, and then look back at all the things that I was able to achieve. That's how you quantify success. Success is about maximizing your potential. And
totally.
And I look back and was able to reach 4 in the world and six slam semis. I won 11 times on the tour and won Olympic silver. You know, that's as good as I was meant to be. So, you know, I think there are times, because the country that I live in, with Wimbledon being that event, you know, suddenly you're judged whether you win that tournament or not. And you know, having been in the semis four times, you know, people sometimes would say, well, he didn't win Wimbledon, so he wasn't a success. But I'm not sure I'd agree with that.
Typical understatement. Not sure you would agree with that. I mean, it's absolute nonsense. And actually, this is why I'm really happy to talk to you about this stuff, because it is narratives like that that are nonsensical. And that's why I was saying, you know, when you were 15, 16, because let's take another player. Let's someone like Richard Gasquet, who was seen as the great hope of French tennis, and the pressure that would go on someone like that. And yes, he's had a good career, but he hasn't won a Masters. I don't think he's really sort of broken the top five, or certainly top four even. And you know, like you say, people develop at different ages, and it's about getting the most out of yourself. And there's absolutely no question that you did that, but narratives just run away with themselves. Because I mean, when you really burst on the scene at around that time, Britons at Wimbledon were going out in the second round, third round, maybe fourth, very occasionally with Jeremy Bates. But before you, the level of expectation was on the floor, and people forget that.
I think that's fair comment, and but again, everybody's journey's different, so why is Jeremy Bates relevant to me? You know, I think then when you go back to sort of talking about it's slightly philosophical about success. It's very easy in sport to sort of quantify success by winning and losing. And you know, tennis is an interesting sport because you, irrespective of how good you are, if you're number one in the world, you still lose a lot. There's still only one winner. You know, in the Grand Slams, you know, the men's and women's, there are 254 losers. There's only two winners. And so when you then take that question to another sport, you know, so how do you quantify success in football? How do you quantify success in cricket? You know, there's no world ranking. You know, is it representing your country, and you know, or is it winning the World Cup? And likewise, if you go into other professions and you say, well, if you were the fourth best lawyer in the world, or you were the fourth best banker in the world, you'd be doing all right. But you know, in sport, I think it's way too easy just to look at it as defined by winning and losing.
Totally agree. And like you say, you can't even compare yourself to Jeremy. Everyone's on their own journey, and it's that old cliche. Ultimately, you're only competing with yourself. And it's clear that you feel like you absolutely got the most out of your game, that you put the absolute maximum into it. From where I am as a tennis fan, that's the way I see it as well. So really, it's winner, loser, success or not. It's about making the most of yourself for yourself. It's an intrinsic thing, isn't it? Rather than an external approval thing, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And I remember I didn't necessarily have a lot of media training, but I remember being told very early on, you know, when you're in interviews, you know, never talk about giving 110%, because it's just not possible. And so likewise, when you appreciate, this is where, when you talk about commitment as an athlete and you know, going about your job to maximize your potential, there are no gray areas. You're either in or you're out. And so therefore, 99% effort and application is not good enough. It's 100% or nothing at all. So then when you break down, you know, my game and the way that I practiced, the way that I trained, my schedule, my effort in my matches, I always gave 100%. And so that's where, when you add it all together, all these pieces of the puzzle, and when you try your best, you can't do more than that. That's why, you know, when people talk about players in lots of sports, you hear people talking about overachieving. Well, overachieving is not possible, because that's to do with your potential. You know, if your potential is 100% and you give 100%, then you'll be successful. You can't say, well, give 110%. It's not possible. So therefore, you know, in my mind, you can't overachieve, but you can certainly underachieve.
Yeah. And that, I find that interesting around where sort of people set goals. So if you had set a goal, let's say, as a 15 or 16 year old of, oh, I want to be in the top 100, to some degree, you would have been potentially limiting yourself. So it's about really exploring what your potential is.
Exactly. Exactly. It's about exploring that. I think that the top 100 narrative is about playing the main tour. You know, if you're top 100, you're going to be getting into the Grand Slams. You're going to be playing in the biggest and best tournaments. And that's why, you know, that gets thrown out there. And it's a good benchmark. But certainly you wouldn't want to say, well, if I get to the top 100, then that's it. And as I said earlier on in this conversation, you always want to be trying to raise the bar higher, you know, think about different areas where you can improve your game. And you know, so when you are 16, 17, it's easier to quantify sort of if you're a 100-meter sprinter. You know, if you're running 100 meters in 14 seconds and you're saying, well, you know, I've got to run it in 10, that's a long way off. You know, if you're 16, 17, just left school and you're losing in the early rounds of junior ITF tournaments, you're talking about being the top 100 player, tennis player in the world. It's a long way off. So they're all, you know, benchmarks. And I do always think it's very important to set yourself goals.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, not have them as a glass ceiling, because see where you can go, but tick them off as you go on the way. Anyway, right, let's go back a bit, because I want to pick through a couple of bits. Now, listen,
yeah,
I want to apologize first, because I've shared this anecdote with you before, and I promise I am never going to do it again. All right, this is the last time I'll ever do it. And you've humored me every time. But I've got to tell us, because it's one of my favorite anecdotes, which is that, so I actually met you on holiday before you were seen as the British number one.
Yeah.
And at that time, Jamie Delgado was the great British hope. He'd won the Orange Bowl. And you humoured me that whole time. And yeah, I just spent all the time saying, Tim, tell me more about Jamie. You know, what's his game like? I was fascinated. And
it
then
was very good.
Yeah. And you were incredibly graceful about it. And I kicked myself that I didn't ever ask you to play, because obviously I think later that year you won the Nationals. The next year, I think, or within a year or two, you beat Greg in the final of the Senior Nationals. And then before we know it, you're playing Kafelnikov in 1996. But for me, that just summed it up, that there I was, sat next to, you know, the best male British tennis player since Fred Perry, or certainly since John Lloyd. And there I was banging on about someone else, which just says about the difference in the journeys. Anyway, I had to share that.
Yeah, and I don't think you were wrong. I mean, Jamie, you know, he's a great friend of mine. I've known him since, you know, I was probably 12 or 13 and he was 9 or 10. Mm. And, you know, it was phenomenal how good he was, age 13, 14. And, you know, when someone is a year younger in juniors, that's quite a lot. When they're 2 years younger, that's a massive amount. If they're 3 years younger, I mean, you sort of feel like you should be barely talking to the person. But, you know, he was beating me pretty comfortably at that stage. And,
wow.
And again,
that,
you know, he was...
That just
says
it all, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, but he was probably, you know, more physically developed than me, was stronger than me. And,
yeah,
and you know, his game was developing at, you know, certainly a different speed. But for me, as I said about my brothers, two older brothers growing up, environment is so important.
Yeah.
And that's why the Slater scheme was very important and was so good for me as an environment, because I was practicing with better players all the time. You know, I'd look at Jamie or I'd look at Mark Maresso or, you know, whoever it was and say, wow, they do that better than me and I need to improve that. And so that no doubt played an important part in my development.
When he won the Orange Bowl, did that increase your belief about what was possible for yourself?
No, I don't think it did. I mean, it just wasn't. I'd never played in the Orange Bowl. I wasn't probably good enough to get into the tournament. I did play, again, the sort of perspective. I played Orange Bowl once in my last year of juniors when I was 17, turning 18. And I lost. It was played on green clay in Miami and I lost 6-1, 6-2 first round.
Wow.
And likewise, you know, in 1992, I played the junior event at Wimbledon for the first time and I lost, ironically, 6-2, 6-1 first round. So in 1992, I went from, you know, I went from winning three games in the first round of the junior event to 4 years later beating the French Open champion in the main event, getting to the quarterfinals. And that, again, emphasizes how everybody's journey is different, but also your improvement sort of graph goes in different gradients. And yeah. So, you know, mine had bottomed out a bit, sort of 16, 17, and then suddenly, you know, 18, 19, as I got stronger and, you know, the physicality, my speed and my strength suddenly transformed my game. Then that was where the upward trajectory was enormous.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Absolutely. And I was keeping a close eye on you at this time. Before we talk 96, quick one. There is a great lesson in 95. Obviously, yeah. You've got that fantastic record of being the first person disqualified from Wimbledon for smacking a ball, unintentionally hitting a ball girl in the yeah. face. I think it's known as doing a Djokovic these days. But but I tell you what,
On the ear. I didn't get her in the face.
So, right. But the way you dealt with it was fantastic. And this, I think, is a real lesson in responsibility. So obviously you and Jeremy Bates were defaulted. No one was happy about that. The umpire, no one wanted it, but it was just it was unavoidable. And then the next day, up you rock, big gleaming smile, bunch of flowers for the ball girl. So you completely took responsibility and really sort of won people back over. Did that experience teach you anything? Did you learn anything from that? Did that help you at all in any way?
Yeah, no doubt. Two things. The first thing was, I remember I was sharing a flat with Andrew Richardson, who was best man at our wedding, who, you know, was same age as me. I grew up playing tennis with him from the age of 11. And we were sharing a flat in Wimbledon Village. And the next morning, after I got disqualified, he went out and bought all the newspapers, mainly the tabloids. And I remember the back page of the Sun, because we were playing Jeff Taranga, which is kind of ironic.
He then walked off court
2 days later. Yeah. The back page of the Sun, the headline was, "He hit it so hard it could have killed her." Which even by the tabloids, standards, that was a pretty severe exaggeration. But I remember reading that thinking, wow, that is just so much garbage. I will never read a newspaper again while I was playing. And I could count on, you know, probably two hands how many times I read the papers for the rest of my career. And the other thing was, having been disqualified, being the first player, a British player, to be disqualified in 125 years at Wimbledon, I remember sort of saying to myself, wow, I'm going to have some fairly decent results to make sure that people don't remember this. And so there was a little bit of a motivating factor there.
That's amazing to really recognize early the hyperbole of particularly the tabloids and not getting swept away by people's judgments.
One other thing that again was, I didn't know it at the time, but was evident throughout my whole career. I had great people around me, and that's first and foremost, you know, was my parents, you know, my coach, my agents, you know, IMG, who still look after me to this day. I didn't have a big group. I never liked a big group of people, but I had, you know, Billy Knight, who was in charge of British tennis at that time, was a huge influence. And I had great people around me to support me, you know, I'll say keep my feet on the ground, but I don't think they needed to do that really. But yeah, in the difficult times, to support you and encourage you, and you know, in the good times, to keep you working hard. So that was definitely important when I got disqualified.
Yeah. So and that's about getting advice and counsel from the people that count, and disregarding the noise that you hear that isn't so necessary. And I think Alex Ferguson spoke about that. I watched him in a documentary when he spoke about the key thing is understanding which voices are important and which aren't. And
yes,
that comes back to that control and what you can control and what you can't.
Yeah, there's no doubt that that is important. You want to block out all the different opinions, but you have to remember that in the role as a tennis player, you end up being the sort of the chief executive of your business. And so you've got to select those people. You've got to select a coach. You've got to select a physio, a fitness trainer, an agent or whatever. And you know, I'd like to think that I did a pretty good job of that. And so therefore you're surrounding yourself with good people, the right people who are giving the correct input. So, you know, those are important decisions and not always easy when you're very young.
Right, let's fast forward 12 months. So there I was. Guess where I was watching it? David Lloyd's house, right? 96, yeah. You're up against Kafelnikov, right? And like I said, before you came along, a lot of second round, third round defeats, Jeremy reaching the fourth, and a lot of five-set heroic defeats as well. I think of Chris Bailey, Josh Wilkinson, Petch, Bates as well. And so you were 3-5 down in the final set against Yevgeny Kafelnikov, who just won the French Open. He'd beaten Sampras in the semi-final, so bang in form. And you're serving a stay in. And I actually just watched it a little bit earlier today on YouTube. And you could see, you know, there's that same thing of, here's going to be another heroic British five-set defeat that we can celebrate and be, oh, he was so close, maybe next time. And I, what I didn't realise, I forgot, was you missed a sitter of a smash at 15-30 to go 15-40 down. But then you pulled out two aces, held that game, broke the next two and won. And for me, it reminds me a little bit, that match of, and some people might think this is an odd parallel, but when England won the Rugby World Cup in 2003, because what I noticed in myself on both occasions was this feeling of, oh no, here we go again. And then boom. Oh no, it doesn't have to be that way. And suddenly the glass ceiling got broken. So, I mean, in terms of that match and that tournament, so reaching the quarterfinals, beating a Grand Slam champion like that, did that shatter, you know, or change your own beliefs around what was possible? And did you notice that ripple out into what other people expected too?
Well, two things. I was... You know, by 96, I was playing some good tennis. You know, I was obviously, you know, I wasn't relying on wild cards to get into the event. So I was pretty confident with my game. But there's no doubt that that day, my life changed. And when I then go into the sort of the minutiae of the match, up two sets to love, you know, nothing to lose, suddenly lots to lose. Kafelnikov plays better. When I'm down 5-3 in the fifth, I'm thinking to myself, I have to make him serve it out. You know, we know that it's never easy serving matches out. And, you know, the crowd have been phenomenal that day. Amazing atmosphere. So when I'm down 15-40, I'm kind of thinking to myself, you idiot, you've got to at least make him serve for it. And so that's where, you know, I was very aggressive. I'm just going to, you know, go for my shots. And, you know, it's having that commitment to then put the score aside to say, you know, this is the way I want to execute these points. And when you look at the last four games, you know, I didn't do a lot wrong. So from being, you know, I think psychologically, subconsciously rather, you know, I didn't want to be another. I was a lot better than just a plucky British loss at Wimbledon. So then to turn that around so quickly was a huge, huge win. And then, you know, the way that the draw opened up, because I had to play then two Brits, which you might have thought could have been, you know, could have been a little bit tricky. But I think with all due respect, I was just a lot better than Danny Sapsford and Luke Milligan. So, you know, I beat them pretty comfortably. And then fourth round, I've got to play Gustafsson, which again is a good draw. It's a good opportunity. But, you know, the momentum and the whole vibe for me around the event and the atmosphere was like nothing I'd ever experienced, because it was just, you know, going on to centre court and feeling so comfortable and confident, but having that support and just reveling in it. It was amazing. It was just, it was so much fun. I just, you know, people talk about, oh God, the pressure and the expectation and the crowd. I'm like, just bring it on. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. Oh, see, that's a fantastic way of looking at it. Rather than pressure and threat, it's, you saw it as excitement and thrill.
Pressure's all self-inflicted.
Yeah.
So totally. If you walk on court with a mindset, wow, you know, there's 15,000 here and there's 15,000 on the hill and there's 15 million on TV and they're all expecting you to win, you know, you'll put yourself under so much pressure, you won't be able to play. Whereas I was going on court thinking, wow, this is my favorite court, my favorite surface. I've got the best support in the world. How good's this? You know,
That just shows the power of framing it then. It's the way you perceive things, isn't it?
Well, it's the way, you know, there's lots of ways of talking about it. You know, we've heard people talking about the chimp on your shoulder and you've got to keep that chimp quiet. You know, that my chimp wasn't able to speak because I was just, you know, enjoying it so much.
Yeah, your chimp was excited, was thrilled. But I'm interested what you said there about, you know, you wanted to make him serve it out. So you were, forget the score, be present and you know, play, get on the front foot. So really that's like playing according to your values, being brave and playing as you intend to be. As you would in any moment. And that can be applied in any area of life. I suppose that's what I'm getting at.
In sport, when you're an attacking player, you want to play points on your own terms. You want to be, I want to be dictating. I want to be aggressive. I want to be proactive rather than reactive. And that's much easier to do on grass, certainly in the conditions that we were playing in 1996.
Is that an attitude, right? And this might sound a bit of a left field one, that can be applied just in life generally, you know, doing things on your own terms, irrespective of the noise that's going on around you. I mean, the old sport as metaphor for life, tennis as a metaphor for life type thinking.
I think so. And I think if you reflect on what's been going on in the world, I think, you know, structure in your life is really important when we've been, you know, sort of shut down for 14, 15 months. You know, it's very easy for the days to sort of roll into one another and you become very unproductive. But, you know, having a plan, whether it's around, you know, exercise or Zoom calls or your diet or whatever it may be, communicating with family and friends, I think that the structure is really important. And, you know, there's a lot more focus on mental health these days. I think that's all interconnected. So, you know, when you get back to the way you want to perform on a tennis court, it's dictated, you know, by your mind. So the way you, I mean, it can be influenced by the way your opponent plays as well, but you've got to set out with a strategy and try and make it happen.
And take responsibility for it and not be, you know what you can control and know what you can't. And for example, you couldn't control the pages of the papers. You couldn't control what people were saying about the fact, you know, when you lost semifinals or whatever. It's focus on the opinions that matter, what you can control, the work you can put in and those kind of things.
Yeah, that's right. And again, my personality is, you know, my family's and my wife's, we're not interested in you know, attention away from these types of things. So it was never a sort of fame game. So what was written, positive or negative, was just never interested me. So, you know, that, I think that helped me, you know, deal with the spotlight, because, you know, during that month, it was, you know, it was a lot of fun, but it was pretty intense. I think it was a different world that we lived in. There was no social media. So it was, you know, the written press, it was TV and radio, and that, you know, Wimbledon was a big story.
Yeah, it really was. Absolutely. I can still picture the back page of the 2001. I think it had you with a tiger's face on it. You know, Tim, the country expects, or something like that. But I think that is an interesting attitude, because a lot of people these days do set out wanting fame, which is just, you know, approval on a mass scale. But I think, you know, it shows with your journey, let's say, because there has been a bit of a narrative around you choked in the semi-finals, which, you know, as someone who understands tennis, is nonsense. You came up against Sampras twice. Ivanisevic just had the wind in his sails and with that serve, and obviously the way Hewitt's game matched up against yours. But it's, if you did live for fame and approval, you can't control the narratives that come along, because in your case, people might say, even though you've debunked this idea of overachieving, but people might say that you did that in your career, or you certainly maxed it out. Yet still, people will be like, oh no, we'll find fault. So relying on fame or seeking fame and seeking approval like that, it's a fool's errand, really.
Yeah, I'm not a person that sort of looks back a great deal, but certainly when I retired from the sport, I was, you know, unbelievably content. It was the right time for me to stop. I wasn't getting any better. You know, I was struggling a little bit with my back, and, you know, we just had our third child. And so, you know, the timing of that was absolutely spot on. But then I was able to reflect on everything that I had achieved, and, you know, things that I hadn't achieved, but was, you know, completely, you know, content, completely delighted and proud of my whole career, because I know that I got everything out of it. I got 100% out of it. So if there are other people that disagree with that, that's fine. I don't care. It's not going to change the way I feel about it. I just think that then if you want to have that discussion, then you've got to say, well, if there's the bar, if I failed, how many successful people are out there?
Yeah.
It's not going to be many.
Absolutely. That ability then of you to be so intrinsically motivated, to really just value the opinion of the important people around you, and then how that played out in terms of your, how easy you found it transitioning into retirement. Do you know where that comes from? And how would you encourage someone to develop that in themselves? You know, a young person growing up now.
Yeah, I think for, you know, for me personally, it's who I am. It was probably part of my upbringing. You know, I'm a level-headed type of person that, you know, when things were going great, I didn't, you know, get carried away. I wasn't arrogant or big-headed or thought I was, you know, any better than anyone else type of thing. But likewise, when things were going badly, a bad run of form or injuries, you know, I was never a type of person to feel sorry for myself. So I've always been on a pretty even keel. And, you know, again, that there are people that are much more volatile, and it's much more of a roller coaster. But as I said, I've always been very honest to myself. I have never, you know, sort of tried to be someone I'm not, and I wouldn't want to be type of thing. So, and again, I think that narrative is part of the people around you. My family have always been the most important thing. You know, that's, you know, our health and that perspective, that it is a game at the end of the day. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, this is where, again, we've been so fortunate with the role models we've got in tennis right now. And, you know, there's this sort of perception that to be the best, you've got to be, you know, a horrible person, and you've got to have this killer instinct. And yes, you've got to work hard, and yes, you've got to be very motivated and determined to win. But when you look at Federer and Nadal, I would say they are the two best ambassadors in all of sport, and you won't meet two more humble, grounded, decent human beings. And I think that's where, you know, they can teach a lot of people a lot of different things around values.
Absolutely. And I keep coming back to humility as such an important value. Did you, along throughout your career, were there big names or were there people who did start believing their own hype, and did it come at a cost to them, without naming names?
Oh, I'm sure, you know, someone like Agassi, you know, he, you know, is a good friend of mine, and we lots of us understand his journey, but you know, I'm sure there were times where he, you know, was pretty off the rails, and you know, had some highs and lows. And but that's you know, part of life. It's we are allowed to make mistakes, and it's how you respond from those mistakes. And there will be, you know, plenty of others. And you know, a good example, I think, now relevant now at a different level is Dan Evans. You know, I have a lot of respect for. You know, he's made some bad decisions. He recognizes those decisions. He's accepted responsibility.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, in a really good place, and really getting the best out of himself. And that's another great lesson, that, you know, you might make some bad decisions along the way, but you can bounce back.
Yeah.
You know, I've enjoyed watching his progress.
Totally. Right, last couple of things, Tim. Who was your best coach, or what makes a great coach? Because you had people like Larry Stefanke, who's a lovely fella, Paul Anacone, David Felgate. What makes a great coach? And if you had to pick one?
Yeah, they all had different things that were very, very important at different times. And, you know, David Felgate, I started working with him with no professional ranking, and, you know, started off in the satellites. And, you know, for him to really instill, I think, the discipline and a mental toughness around my game. I had, you know, the competitive drive and hunger to work hard, but, you know, bringing a discipline to my game, shot after shot, point after point, was massively important. I think Larry Stefanke really made me understand my strengths more, my athletic ability, my net game, how I could impose myself more, put more pressure on my opponents, and really play on my own terms. And, you know, I think with Paul Anacone, with his experience and knowledge, you know, helping to really piece that all together, which, you know, probably, you know, was a reflection of how well I played in 2004. So, you know, to answer your question more directly, I would say Paul Anacone was the best coach I ever worked with.
Nice. Right. And then,
but that's certainly no disrespect to the other two.
No. And I mean, all of their CVs are great, but Paul's is quite something. Mm. And then we've talked about personal journeys, and you know, everyone sort of goes on different trajectories, progresses at different speeds. So, you know, you don't want to write yourself off at any point. But equally, I think that people do raise the bar in a way to help other people. You sowed the seed, I think, for the success that came later with Andy. You did raise that bar, that expectation, in such a way that enabled Andy to go on. Now, I'm not saying you take responsibility for his win, but you that was a factor in his ability to go on and reach the very top, wasn't it?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And again, it comes back a little bit to environment. And, you know, the environment doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, I'm practicing and training with him every day, but the environment of a mindset that, you know, this is the healthy competition that goes with, you know, players from the same country. So for British tennis, me, you know, having been in the top five in the world and, you know, done X, Y, and Z, that is no doubt going to be within his psyche, as it were.
Yeah.
And then, you know, being around, whether it's practicing or Davis Cup or at tournaments or competing, you know, there's no doubt that that's, you know, important sort of stepping stone. And so I always enjoyed. I think because we were, I can't remember how many years older than I am, but it's obviously quite a few. It's probably 11 or 12. I think that's where, if he had been closer in age, I think there would have been, it would have been a harder relationship, because I think we'd been more of rivals, as it were. But because we were so far apart and at different stages of our career, I always, you know, really enjoyed, you know, the time that we spent together, whether it was traveling and practicing and training. I mean, the matches were hard. I think they were hard first and foremost because I didn't like the matchup in my game style. It's a bit like playing a better version of Hewitt. Yeah. But I've always been, you know, a massive supporter of Andy's and still speak to him pretty regularly. And you know, what he has gone on to achieve has been, you know, incredible to watch.
Yeah, but you sowed the seed. Right, let's just summarise then in terms of lessons then, Tim, because I do think what I take from your story really is around that being in competition with ourselves, ultimately, not others.
Yeah.
You know, how we define ourselves, as it's far too simplistic, this winners and losers, because,
yeah,
you know, we're all losers, aren't we? It's, you're a winner if you are really maximize or try your best, to put it really simply. And then, yeah, and in terms of you, I mean, like you said, you're level-headed. You know, you've always seemed content and happy to me when I've seen you. You obviously, you moved into retirement pretty easily. So that intrinsic sense of self-worth, that in not needing external approval, that's a really valuable lesson I think people can learn from. Would you agree on that sort of summary?
Yeah, but look, you know, first and foremost, I'm very, very fortunate. You know, I'm, touch wood, I'm, you know, I'm healthy. My family, my wife, my kids, you know, my parents, my in-law, you know, my extended family, and we're very lucky. That's the most important thing. You know, with my, you know, tennis life, the psychology of that is, it's about the process, not the outcome. You know, the outcome is almost a byproduct. If you get the process right and do everything you can, it's tough to argue with the outcome. And so, you know, for me, I'm, you know, so content with what I, you know, was able to achieve. Would I do things differently? Yes, in hindsight, I would have, you know, avoided matches that I got injured, or, you know, I might have played a different schedule, or, you know, I might have developed my game slightly different, but you know, that's hindsight. You know, I look back and so proud of all the things that I did achieve.
Right, just finally, who's going to win Wimbledon?
I think Djokovic. Djokovic.
Oh, Tim, well, come on. Change the record, for goodness sake.
Yeah. Djokovic on the men's. On the women's, who would I like to see? I mean, Ash Barty's been very impressive. I really like the way Andreescu has played. She hasn't played a lot, but she's got a very sort of dynamic game. I think there's a lot of great stories on both sides. I think the women's game is exciting because there are so many different players knocking on the door. And if we could see Federer and Murray competing properly, that would be we'd sign for that right now.
How nice would that be? Yeah. Absolutely. That would be something very special. Like, I can't wait to see it. I'm very much looking forward to seeing you. And like I said, I promise I will never mention the holiday anecdote ever again. That's it. It's done for now. You're free. Anyway, listen, Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure.
No, I really enjoyed it.
I've got so much joy from watching you play throughout your career and now getting to work alongside you and have chats like this. It's a real pleasure. So just thank you very much indeed for coming on and sharing your lessons. It's been great.
No problem at all. Really enjoyed it. All the best. Cheers, Simon.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode with Tim Henman. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did and wanted to spread the love and could share this episode with someone who you think might enjoy it, or if you could leave a rating and a kind review on Apple Podcasts, I would be hugely grateful. Anything that you could do to spread the word about Don't Tell Me The Score really does make a huge difference. A reminder that you can sign up for my weekly newsletter at simonmundy.com, and do follow me on Instagram for loads of great Wimbledon content over the next fortnight. And do keep your eyes peeled for yours truly on BBC TV.
from the All England Club. That's it for this week. Thank you again for listening. I do really appreciate it. And I hope you'll join me again next time on Don't Tell Me The Score.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.